Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. This week, we're going to be taking a look at the Danny Boyle, Alex Garland science fiction film, 2007's Sunshine. Before we get to that, let's get to feedback and a little genre news. Feedback department, I want to thank a Twitter user named Patrick for giving me a great message, some great feedback about the podcast. Patrick, thank you for that message. He spells it Patrick, the A is an at sign. Huge thanks to Chris Guinard, Morton Steen, and my good friend Michaela Shank, who pledged to Sci-Fi on Screen on Patreon. So we're rocking and rolling towards our initial goal of $50, with which I can create a little sound booth for myself and upgrade my mic and my equipment, get the podcast sounding really, really great. So thanks again, Chris and Morton and Michaela. I wanted to thank Brendan Place for his comments on Facebook. I goofed when I was in my AI artificial intelligence podcast where I mentioned that Ministry was from Germany. Ministry is from Chicago. For whatever reason, I think I put Rammstein in my head, who are from Germany and not Ministry. But anyway, thanks, Brendan, for correcting me. Thank you to Michelle Torbidone, who's my friend in Italy, who posted about my AI podcast, a really long Facebook post on my page. Really appreciating the post. And Michelle, as always, I appreciate you're out there and thank you so much for that. It was really great to read. Thanks to Carlo for posting a picture of the A1 steak sauce. It was a bit about the AI artificial intelligence at the end where they did some, you know, preliminary surveys to see how the name was going to fly, as they were just going to call it AI. And people were getting confused that it was A1 steak sauce. So thanks, Carla, for the picture. Thanks to Adam McAlvey, who sent me a message that he's a fan of Nigel Neal and the Quatermass TV shows that were originally aired in Britain, urging me. I think at one point I tried to watch them, and they were just so kind of didactic in an old-school TV kind of way that I didn't get into it. But Adam was urging me to try to get past that and finish it, so I'm going to put those back on my list, see if I can get to them. He also mentioned, you know, being British and me being American, there's an inherent Britishness to the proceedings that he may be more apt to enjoy than I would. But anyway, thank you, Adam, for that. And I also want to thank Ron Latimer for a great email that he sent. He discovered my podcasts listening on his commute to work, and he's gone through and listened to my whole catalog, which really appreciate that. Really glad to see that you're enjoying it. And wants me to review some M. Night Shyamalan. And the two Shyamalan films that I think I'm going to get to eventually, one of them being The Sixth Sense, obviously, but also Unbreakable. So those two will be in the mix at some point in the future. I want to thank some folks who retweeted my Solaris podcast on Twitter: Matt Hurt, David Melville, David Alexander, Chris Guinard, Hedge9084, and again, Patrick for retweeting me. Thank you, guys. Really appreciate that. Okay, so let's jump into some news around the genres, as it were. There's been some rumblings there's going to be an Altered Carbon TV show. I don't know if you guys are aware of an author, Richard K. Morgan. He's an English author, wrote Altered Carbon, Woken Furies, I think one or two more, the Takeshi Kovacs novels, basically. They're kind of like these William Gibson-esque cyberpunk noir series. They got a little more military in the third and fourth book. Anyway, they're looking to make them a TV series, which would be very interesting. I imagine the production value is going to have to be pretty high. It's a pretty high tech future, but very Blade Runner, cyberpunk, William Gibson-ish. But good books in their own right. You know, very realized world, really well written. First book, Altered Carbon, I really highly recommend. It's a really terrific book. So the Assassin's Creed trailer dropped recently. You know, it looked very flashy. Lots of slow-mo and kind of matrixy photography of the leaps and the chase on the rooftops. And the wonderful to see the leap of faith off the tall building. Fassbender looks really cool. I'm assuming he plays, I think it's Altieri is the main character. But if it's the Spanish Inquisition, I think it's a little bit later than the first Assassin's Creed game. I might be wrong. But anyway, it looked impressively mounted, and there's money on the screen. But I couldn't get a feel for the film, really. I couldn't get a sense of it. But there's still hope out there that it might be something interesting and not just some kind of flashy video game property. But we shall see. And lastly, actually this morning as I'm recording this podcast, I just saw the second Star Trek Beyond trailer. And, you know, marginally better than the first trailer, but I really wasn't put off my estimation of what the first trailer made me think the movie was going to be like. Mostly action-adventure with a lot of witty, pithy lines and, you know, directed by the guy who did The Fast and the Furious, last, I think, two films. There was a line in the trailer which I did not like, which made me think that, like the two Abrams movies, that they don't really have the soul of Star Trek in their core here, and Uhura is captured and prisoner somewhere, and you know we're getting there's a line from her that says something about, you know, when Kirk gets here, the last thing on his mind will be mercy. And for any kind of a Star Trek fan, that is, you know, such an anti Star Trek line. Even the fact that Uhura, the female, is, you know, the woman is captured and kidnapped, or she's being held somewhere. To me, that's very retrograde, you know, that we're into like Star Wars territory and people are captured and we have to go be rescued. And it's all action adventure-y. It has very little to do with Star Trek. So I'm going in with very low expectations. What also dropped was the teaser to the Star Trek TV show, which was about as teasery as a teaser can get. You got absolutely nothing but like, you know, the Star Trek logo and the fact that there's going to be a new cast and new villains and new adventures. And it seems that, you know, CBS is going to try to really break away from, even though they're keeping it in the canon continuity, they're going to try to, you know, make a brand new show out of this, which I'm more excited for that because I think Trek really belongs on the small screen. I think it's at home. It espouses most of the best parts of the show are better suited to the television format. I think that when you have to blow Trek up to be a two-hour, you know, big budget sci-fi epic, you lose a lot of the ethos that make Trek Trek. And it turns into like a pale imitation of Star Wars. So, still not convinced. Simon Pegg, you know, part of the writing and abashedly a huge fan. It's possible he's a fan of the characters, and given his comedic bent, that this is going to be kind of what I think it is, an action adventure comedy. But, you know, I will be happy to be surprised. They're gonna have my money. So, you know, they're getting my money, which is all they really want. But, you know, whether they're going to have my allegiance is another story. Okay, so let's jump into some background about Sunshine. March 2005, following the completion of Danny Boyle's film Millions, the director received the script from scriptwriter Alex Garland, who had worked with Boyle before on The Beach in 2000 and 28 Days Later in 2002. Along with producer Andrew McDonald, Boyle and Garland pitched the script to 20th Century Fox, who were reluctant to finance the film based on the similarities to the remake, which I just covered, 2002 Solaris, which was a dismal box office failure. Fox then financed it, Fox Searchlight, which I guess is a lower budget engine of the Fox distribution company. So it was a $40 million budget. Then producer McDonald got some outside financing from British lottery funds and other, you know, the Byzantine ways that films get funded. With the correct financing in place, Boyle entered pre-production work for Sunshine. And since Boyle had previously worked with Fox Searchlight on 28 Days Later, he was afforded a fairly wide latitude in terms of final cut working for the studio, which is even more disappointing. For me, when, you know, and I'll get to that when we talk about this film, that, you know, he wasn't really hemmed in by a big studio making changes, that this is the movie that he and Garland wanted. So I'll get to that. Screenwriter Alex Garland was inspired to write Sunshine based on scientific ideas about the heat death of the universe, specifically, quote, an article projecting the future of mankind from a physics-based atheist perspective, end quote, according to Garland. The article was from the American Scientific Periodical, an American scientific periodical, and Garland had wondered about what would result from the son's death. So he brought the script to Danny Boyle, who took up the project due to his longtime desire to direct a science fiction film in space. Boyle and Garland worked on the script for about a year, creating 35 drafts in their experimenting, which again, very surprising when you get to the finished film. When finished, Boyle said that he would never return to the sci-fi genre, citing exhaustion with the production requirements and the special effects. So, director Danny Boyle before this had done Trainspotting, among other things, The Beach with Leo DiCaprio, 28 Days Later, obviously, and the film Millions before working on Sunshine. Writer Alex Garland started out as a novelist who wrote the novels The Beach and The Tesseract. And then I think later he probably co-wrote or wrote the screenplay to The Beach, and then wrote the original screenplay to 28 Days Later with Boyle all before Sunshine was made. Okay, so let's get to the film. The film opens up with a voiceover, and we're looking at the Earth. The voiceover is from the character named Kappa, who's played by Cillian Murphy. It's, quote, "Our sun is dying. Mankind faces extinction. 7 years ago, the Icarus Project sent a mission to restart the sun, but that mission was lost before it reached the star. 16 months ago, I, Robert Kappa, and a crew of seven left the Earth frozen in a solar winter, our payload, a stellar bomb with a mass equivalent to Manhattan Island. Our purpose, to create a star within a star," end quote. And I got to say, after this opening quote, I am in, as a sci-fi fan. This is like old school hard sci-fi, like the sun is dying. It's a scientific mission to restart the sun. Amazing, so rare in this day and age to have a brand new intellectual property come in that's this hard science based to start with anyway. So very much excited about the film once I hear this voiceover and I get in. First, we're getting a look at the Icarus II, which is the main ship that they sent. We start with the front of the heat shield, which is very similar to the shape of an eyeball, and they do a lot of photography that takes in the heat shield. And also, Danny Boyle closes in, he focuses on very much on people's eyeballs, and a lot of the film, it's kind of the theme of this film, is protection from this incredible power and this incredible heat and light, and at the same time, our own organs with which we perceive it. So as a visual theme throughout the movie, it's very clever. So the Icarus II is very cool. It's basically the Discovery with a hat, as I like to call it. It's kind of a long, spindly ship. It has certain aspects of it that are spinning around in the torso of the ship, but at the front is this massive heat shield to protect it from the heat and light of the sun. So very cool design. I really think it's really neat, just this ship heading for the sun. We start out with the psychologist and doctor, Dr. Searle, and he's in this observation lounge. And we've got the sun right in the center, and it's been massively filtered. We hear him instruct the female artificial intelligence to allow in more light. And at 36 million miles at that point, he's only able to withstand 2% of full brightness. He pushes it to 3.1%. When the iris opens, the camera gets his reaction. He's almost stunned by it. And this is the beginning of part of what I love about this film, that it teases this idea of this mystical, in a sense, religious connection with this the sun and the amount of light and the experience of that much light on a human body, on a human psyche, in a way. It's the beginning of a wonderful tease that is so not paid off on by the film, but something that I take out of the film and I kind of have my own fun with it, but it's a nice moment. And what I like what they do also, they must have just sat around talking about the nature of what the light and the heat from the sun is going to be like as far as the film goes. So when you're doing the exterior shots of the Icarus II, they make the sound design, it makes the light out to be almost this like incredibly powerful, loud, violent force that's acting on the ship. And whereas not just bright light, and I think that was probably part of the problem the filmmakers talked about, like, we have to make the light itself a character in the film. So whenever they go exterior and we see that we're closing up on the shield, or there are crisis moments when the light is sort of, advancing on them. It's done in a very audible way. A lot of sound design concerned with what sort of the impact emotionally of this light and heat. And I really think it's a good choice, because the sunlight does become sort of like this power and this extra character in the film. And I think they do achieve that. So we start out, it's definitely a couple, there's callbacks to this film of Alien and 2001. You know, the opening scene in the film being around the sort of the mess hall table, a very alien-ish. And we get an initial monologue from Searle as he's telling the other crew members about his experience with the light and the sun on the observation deck. I really like what he's talking about. It's this great introduction to, you know, the nature of what they're going towards. And he's talking about it felt like taking a shower in light. And he talks about, you know, how darkness is something that's separate from you. You feel alone in darkness and that it really separates you and really isolates you. And that light is different, and that light is envelops you, and it almost joins with you to the point where, you know, you almost merge with it at certain levels or certain points, which is wonderful. You know, I mean, think about it in a spiritual sense, darkness and light. I mean, to physicalize it in this way, I liked it right off the bat, and it makes Searle the most interesting character in this film. I know that Kappa is the lead actor and lead character, but as I will get to, I don't think most of the characters in this film really come through as interesting people or interesting characters in any way. But Searle does. And Searle, and I think the actor who plays Searle is part of it, this guy named Cliff Curtis. He's really good. There's something very honest and abashed about him disclosing this information, and the rest of the crew kind of ignore it and make fun of it. But to me, it makes him the most interesting character, and it's unfortunate that they do so little with him. Also, one thing to notice as you're watching this film from the beginning is the photography is just beautiful. I mean, Danny Boyle really, and his DP, just beautiful photography. The ship looks wonderful. You know, inside the ship, everything's very bright and crisp and clear. It's just such a crisp, wonderful cinematography in the film. I love looking at the ship, and I love looking at things in the ship and on the screen just because of how wonderful the photography is. You know, and especially when you're focused on the sun, there's so many different aspects of the, you know, solar radiation that they deal with as the movie goes on, and they're all photographed in wonderful ways. I mean, I feel like it's definitely something that they focused on very much, what the visual look of this film was going to be and how they were going to deal with some of the elements, the natural elements that are present in it. They really put a lot of time and energy into it. It really shows because it's really beautiful to see. The sound design is always kind of shifting. You're looking at the ship from the outside. It's almost as if you're underwater. You hear these little recurring beeps and sonar-like sounds, you know, that are coming from the ship, you know, almost as if it's like a sub, you know. So I don't know, I just kind of like it. So we get our first little bit of information in this introductory period. They're heading into the part of their journey where the solar wind is so high and intense that it's going to obscure any communication messages that they're going to have to send back to Earth. So they all record these last messages, which they're going to send back. And we see most of Kappa's, Cillian Murphy, recording his. And as he's recording his, we're cutting a little bit around to the other people on the ship. And that's the first time we see Corazon, played by the wonderful Michelle Yao, in her oxygen garden. She's the biologist. We see her tending to her plants. And, you know, this cuts to other parts of the ship and other characters as they're doing, you know, things that they do. During this, we hear this voiceover from Kappa. He's telling his, I believe it's his sister who he's recording it for, that, you know, light takes 8 minutes to reach Earth, and that on a particular morning, if you wake up and you see a particularly bright sky and a bright sunlight, you'll know that we've succeeded. So definitely setting up the end of the movie big time, there it is. And Cillian Murphy, he's a very believable actor. I don't really know how good of an actor he is, and I only say this because he's so charismatic that when he's on screen, he doesn't have to do much, and I'm there with him. Like, you know, Scarecrow in Batman Begins, and, you know, the other films that he's been in, I always immediately take him seriously, and I'm immediately in whatever character that he's part of, which I think is just like a natural gift. But I don't think that I've ever seen him pushed to a level where I thought this guy's an amazing performer. Like, he has these amazing eyes, really big, wide eyes. He doesn't blink a lot, so he holds your attention on screen effortlessly, I think. So I really like him. But again, I don't know, you know, in terms of stretching as an actor and a performer, I don't know that he's ever been really put to any extremes or any kind of test to see if he's got real chops or it's just a natural movie star's charisma. But either way, shorthand to say that I do like him. We get a brief conversation of the captain. We meet a character named Kaneda talking with Corazon about O2 production. and that, you know, because of the O2 garden, they'll have enough oxygen to get there and back because they're making their own, and speculating on the fate of the Icarus 1, which is the first time. Obviously, Icarus 2, we assume there's been a first ship. We've heard from voiceover from Kappa that it was lost, and, you know, now they're speculating on what the fate of the ship might be. Then we cut right to Mace and Kappa in a full-on fist fight, more of a wrestling match. Mace is played by none other than Captain America himself, Chris Evans, who I like in this film, although I don't think he has much to work with, but I see him trying to do something. So after the fight, you have Mace going to Searle, who's the doctor slash psychologist, and he doesn't say much. He's just kind of surly and mute. I don't know what Alex Garland is going for here. You know, like that long space travel pushes people beyond their limits. Are they setting up this explanation of why Pinbacker went crazy? It's like, I don't know, the early part of this film, and I'll get to that in a little bit, it's just kind of glib and shallow. Like Mace, they fight. We don't know why they fought. Mace is in to see the psychologist. He doesn't say anything. Then the next scene is Mace going to Cap and apologizing, but we don't know why, so it's all kind of, like, weird for us. And basically, you know, most of these scenes, we're not really putting any meat on character bones here. Searle is great with the sunlight and his kind of spiritual moment, but Cap and Mace get in a fight for no reason that we, you know, we're not told what the reasons are. You know, we don't get any sense of any of the other characters and what their deal is. They're just, I don't know, it's like the writer really doesn't have much of a story in the beginning of this film until they discover the Icarus One. They're just kind of playing around here, and we're not really getting to know anyone, why they came on the mission. And I feel like there was such meat here that you have these seven people that have gone on what might be most likely be a one-way mission. And if they fail, the human race is doomed. That you're not going to get inside the heads of each one of them and what brought them to the mission and why they're there and how they feel about all that. And you're going to be glib and sort of circumspect about it all. It's just maddening to me. And I think the film pays for it dearly later on when you're asked to invest in these characters. A brief note on the music. It's done by this guy named John Murphy and also this band, Underworld. It's great. The soundtrack is really great. There are times as the film gets on further that I think it's used too much. And Danny Boyle did this in 28 Days Later too, where he can push a soundtrack where he'll do a slow, steady build as music gets louder and more intense and louder and more intense, and then he holds it for a while. If it's done right and the action on screen matches the intensity of the music, you've got an incredibly powerful sequence. But there are times in this film, I feel like, where the music is trying to do all the dramatic work. What's on screen is not matching up with it, and you get a weird kind of mismatch that makes some scenes feel overblown, and I will get to those as we go. But it's beautiful music, nonetheless. We get a brief moment where Kaneda is now playing back Pinbacker's communication, one of his last communications that he sent prior to Icarus One's blackout. And Pinbacker is played by actor Mark Strong, and he's describing the meteor storm that hit the Icarus One and the repairs they have to make, and how the destruction of the meteorites to the Icarus One was beautiful, right? And I thought to myself, in any kind of genre movie, or any kind of movie, whenever a character thinks destruction is beautiful, immediately they're going to be a bad guy. I find it funny. Like, it's a classic bad guy introduction. Then there's a brief tag, and we watch Mace. Mace is sort of the computer tech genius guy. Most of the elements of the flight computer are kept in this super cooled liquid, and we see him manipulating that, bringing it out briefly for some maintenance, and has to put it back in. It can't be left out very long. So that's the first little tag we're getting, you know, and that's going to be part of the dramatic structure later on, and some things are going to be going on with the computer. So we're given a glimpse of it here to set that up. Then we have this wonderful moment where they observe the transit of Mercury around the sun. And it's beautiful. It's done with this wonderful, sublime little music cue. Very much science. The crew, being mostly scientists, they gather around in mutual satisfaction and glee. You know, there's no taciturn. There's no people on the crew here that are like, who cares? Fuck that. I'm not going to watch a stupid planet. You know, like, they all come together in their mutual love of science and space. Kaneda dramatically, you know, opens up the observation port, and we see Mercury, you know, in a swift orbit around the sun. I don't know if it's scientifically accurate. I don't particularly care about that kind of stuff. I think the emotional moment was really good, and it's very potent. They're all sitting there smiling and watching, and the photography is so beautiful. The photography of the sun and of this body playing out in front of it, and the illusion that we're getting of speed, like, it's all really well photographed. And I don't know, I really loved the sequence. It was just a wonderful sense of, like, we don't really ever get much of passion of scientists or the passion of science or the awe and wonder of science in science fiction films. It's usually bad guys and laser guns and all that kind of crap, you know? But one of the rare scenes where, you know, a film can really bring out what would drive people to become scientists and to get involved in space science and astrophysics. And as they just sit quite content to just watch the transit of Mercury over the face of the sun. So really love it. It's a great scene. You know, and part of me was thinking, too, that, like, Searle started the thread of, you know, that much light or being exposed to that much light as kind of a spiritual force, that you're enveloped by it and it's comforting. That they're watching this body that's been orbiting, you know, so close to the sun for, you know, for eons and will continue to continue to orbit via eons. And what is that like to be a certain distance? Because, you know, there is a certain metaphor here that the sun is God. And that being so close to God, depending on who you are, would either drive you mad or, you know, bring you to some transcendence and envelopment in God, which I think, you know, I'll get to at the end of the film, which is what I like to think about. It's not so much what the film dwells on, but I enjoy thinking about it. But, like, you know, what is Mercury but kind of like a way station of, like, it's almost there, but not quite. It's almost like Mercury is purgatory in this film. I don't know, just some thoughts. So again, you know, we're just about to kick off our plot. So up till now, like, you've had some great photography. I mean, the film looks great. The transit of Mercury scene is really wonderful. There's virtually no character development whatsoever. Like, the film doesn't feel like it knows what it needs to do with the people on it. And later on, when you finally get a sense of what the film's going to be, you realize that these are all just going to be victims. You know, they're just going to be people that are sacrificed for the sake of the story. But we never really come to care much about them. I don't, personally. The one interesting character that I do like, Searle, is not given much of a through line in the film, and what he's experiencing is only given brief name checks a couple of times before he finally meets his end, you know, in the future. It's a weird beginning, and I think because the film isn't so sure of who its people are, you know, it doesn't have much weight as we go. So it's again, it's a very scattershot opening. I don't think the film knew what it wanted to do yet. It's going to start with its story. Once it gets into the story, like, it's, you know, it's going to find some of its strengths. Before it ultimately finds its major weaknesses.
Don't tell me they don't use money in the 23rd century.
Well, we don't.
Yes, my friends, but we do use money in the 21st century. Let's think about $1 for a minute. If you contribute $1 per episode via Patreon, it's $4 a week, $52 a year. If you like what I'm doing at Sci-Fi on Screen, you're really enjoying the show, I invite you to become a Patreon subscriber. My first goal I'm setting is $50 per show. I'm at about $26 and change right now. At $50 a show, I would really like to improve the quality of the sound for you guys, and I could buy a really good microphone and a booth so you guys can get the best sound I could possibly provide. So $1 a show a week. Sign up at patreon.com/sci-fi on screen. There's a button on my website, takes you right to the site. Signing up is a snap, and you're on your way. Until the 23rd century does arrive and we no longer need money, I would love your support via Patreon. Thanks for listening.
Blah, 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 blah,
blah, blah, blah, blah. No, blah, blah, blah!
So, we get the Icarus One entry now into the story that the communications officer, Harvey, hears the signal. They plot it. And, you know, we're all with the crew now as they're listening to the beacon. As they're listening, what they're saying is that, and they're very close to Mercury, they're about to do a slingshot around Mercury, which will give them some added velocity that will help them get to their mission sooner. And there's something about the iron content of Mercury, which is amplifying the sound. So possible, scientists out there, you can tell me whether that's real or not. I don't know. I like it. It's an element that makes sense to me in a filmic sense, so I'm happy about it. And we're cutting a lot to really close flybys of Mercury, which I really like, and Mercury looks beautiful on screen. We come to the first choice that the, you know, the mission, the captain has to make, and that they're going to pass close enough to Icarus One on the way to deliver their payload, whether or not they will route over and try to board Icarus One to find out what happened. And so, you know, the captain throws it out there, and Mace is starting to, you know, Mace's character, I guess, is pretty well formed and not that interesting, but he's basically the realist. He's one to always cleave to the mission, not to be sentimental. He's the American, you know, the gung-ho American is willing to be on mission regardless. He says, obviously, no. You know, and he speaks to the people in the audience, like myself, who are like, you can't get too involved in petty dramatics here because you're on, like, the most important mission in human history. you know, you can't afford to really make any kind of half-assed choices based on the film needs a dramatic heft here and there. But they deal with this directly because the captain basically says, you know, it's Kappa's choice. He's the payload expert. So we gather that the Cillian Murphy character is the one who designed the bomb, the stellar bomb. What he's saying is everything about the bomb is theoretical, and would it help us to have two payloads and two bombs? In case one doesn't work, you know, we could possibly secure the second one and have another one. Which was great, because I think any mediocre film would have just brushed off, like, you know, they were just like, there would have been this bullshit argument, like, we got to go rescue them. We don't know what happened. We got to go see what happened. And they just would have gone, and to hell with logic. But I like that at least Garland deals with it, and he comes up with a really good reason for them to go, which is great, because there really can't be any heroics here. That's what, you know, that's the tough thing about this kind of a movie and this kind of a story is the stakes are so high that you really can't have any brash heroics. And when they do happen in the film, not heroics, but when kind of petty emotional human, you know, feelings get involved, like, they seem so off, because it's hard as a viewer to ever think that anyone in this crew is ever going to not realize how important the mission is and that everything should be sacrificed for its completion, right? So, but the choice has real resonance. You know, Kappa goes and he runs all his... First, he takes some time, first of all, and he goes back to his sort of payload pub bay, and he's mocking up how the payload's going to deliver, and the computer's basically telling him, you know, that there's a certain level of delivery where there's too many variables and it can't predict actually what's going to happen to this bloody thing. We're told that they have 6 minutes to escape once they've triggered the bomb, you know, that they need to escape on the Icarus. They have 6 minutes to do it until it detonates. We also hear that they've mined all of Earth's fissile materials. So, like, this is the last bomb. The bomb on the Icarus 2 and the Icarus 1 are the last two payloads. That's it. You know, there's no more materials to mine. He comes down on getting the second bomb just to be sure. So, you know, I like that they spend this much time and that they make the reason for them to go visit Icarus 1, which is what the whole story is going to be based on. It's really grounded in something that, as an audience member, I can put my teeth on, you know. So now we get a quick cut of Searle, who's back in the observation lounge pushing the exposure to the sun. So he's on his kind of, you know, his little spiritual journey. And then we cut to Cassie and Kappa, who are in some kind of intimate relationship, and they're both kind of sharing that they're dreaming of the sun now. That's all everyone dreams of here, but there's no real dialogue between them, you know, no real relationship. She's kind of like a downer with nothing much really about her that we've seen in the film. But she does sort of support him by saying that I'm with you getting the second bomb. I think it's a smart idea. So then we get the big crisis. So there's this wonderful, you know, the alarm is, after all this quietness, we get this huge alarm and everyone's running through the ship. Trey, who is, I believe, the astrophysicist, and we find out that when he altered course to intercept the Icarus 1, he forgot to alter the angle of the actual heat shield, because the ship was in a different angle, and he had an angle, I guess, that the shield towards the sun, so it's like perfectly 100%, and he forgot. So something's gone wrong, and unfortunately, this whole thing bothers me. I mean, the whole sequence is meant to give them a crisis so much so that they have to go to Icarus 1, even though they're already going there, which is kind of story-wise, the film is starting to get a little odd, like, right away. What we don't know is what's wrong, right? We don't know what the sun did. We know that there are some things that popped up on the surface of the sun shield that have to be closed. We don't know this until later, but so there's some problem that the audience is not made aware of, and all we know is that they have to go EVA. So Kaneda, the captain, goes, and then he allows Mace to volunteer Kappa, right? Because Mace is all pissed off, and he blames Kappa for all the deaths because it was Kappa's decision to go to Icarus 1 to get the second bomb. But, you know, when you think of the import of this mission, Kappa is like one of if not the most important person on the ship, because when they finally end the mission and they get there, he's the only one who can, you know, manipulate the payload to such a degree to, you know, explode the bomb. So now we're starting with our emotional choices to make, you know, because Cillian Murphy is the star of the movie, you know, he's got to be involved in some of the main crisis, right? So that's my theory. As I said, he's a star, so he's in on this, right? So him and Kaneda go out EVA, and the suiting up sequence is really authentic, feels good, like, it definitely feels realistic. And then solid suspense, you know, this is a real problem. It doesn't feel fake at all. And I love the gold armored suits, which are really neat. When they open the airlock, there's this great effect of lots of dust, which is really cool because in a lot of space movies, space is very clean in and around ships and stuff. It's very clean and pristine. And here we see massive amounts of dust just sort of exiting from the airlock, which, you know, just human skin and whatever it was, detritus. Kind of like that. Throughout this whole sequence now, there's tension, but we really don't know what the hell they're out there to do. They go find some ports that are open, and Kaneda has to close them. Cap is just kind of waiting around, not doing much. And then we get these quick cuts back to the oxygen farm. They do this thing where they alter the angle of the shields to give Kaneda and Kappa as much shade as they can when they go out and do their repairs. And because of that, they expose the communications antennas to direct sunlight, and they're sheared off, like, you know, immediately. But they're still spinning around. And I think, I blame the film for not making this clear, but I think they're spinning around, and because of the odd angle there are, there's like a reflection of sunlight that reflects off of these spinning towers and directly into the oxygen farm, which starts a fire. And so we don't know really what's going on, except we're getting these little oblique cuts back. Nothing's really happened yet. And then all of a sudden, the artificial intelligence takes over the Icarus II and starts to cant the ship back towards normal flight, which would expose, obviously, Kappa and Kaneda, who are out there doing their repairs. So then we're told by Kaneda that if they don't finish their repairs, the ship will burn up, you know, like the heat shield will fail and the Icarus II will die. So he can't return to the airlock, but he sends Kappa back because it's like the last repair thing they have to do. And so he sends Kappa back. There's this little dramatic moment where finally they get control of the ship back and they're going to keep it oriented towards where it was so Kaneda can finish his work and the oxygen farm be damned. But Kaneda said, you got to save the oxygen farm. So, and Mace is the one who kind of chimes in and says, let's not fix this. You know, we need to let the computer control the ship now and be damned with whoever is both out there, which is absurd because if Kappa dies, the mission's over, you know. So something doesn't ring true about this whole sequence. And because it's not clear what actually went wrong, you just kind of like, as a viewer, I'm just kind of like on the sidelines, like, okay, problems. They're making decisions. Somehow the O2 farm is burning, and they're making decisions based on it. And it's very unclear what's driving all this. At one point, you know, they do come down upon the side that Kaneda is going to sacrifice himself. The fire won't go out in the O2, so they pump oxygen in there to do like this flash burn to blow it out. But the garden is lost. That's over. And then, you know, Cap is almost to safety, and Kaneda closes the final panel, but he doesn't turn around to try to escape because he knows he's not going to make it. So he turns and faces the light, and the light is like a wave. It's as the ship is turning back towards the sun, the light is creeping back over the sun shield, and it's a beautiful moment when the light hits him like a wave. Photography is really beautiful, and you see Searle on the bridge, and Searle's like, "What do you see, Kaneda? What do you see?" Because, you know, Kaneda's going to go all the way here. And so, you know, Searle thinks that there is something about passing into the light that's, you know, that's very spiritual and very powerful. And he wants Kaneda to sort of see if he can narrate what's going on, but he doesn't. But we do get this astonished look on Kaneda's face. So obviously something has happened when the light reaches him. And it's really beautiful, very mysterious, very wonderful. The music really is driving and building up, as you know, Danny Boyle likes to do. It's a very powerful thing when he's enveloped. There's a scream. He doesn't try to escape. And again, we're tantalized by this little spiritual through line in the film, you know, of like, what is this passing into the light? And so it's cool, even though there's a lot of stuff around the sequence that is starting to throw me out of the movie because I realize the filmmakers don't really know kind of what they want to tell me in a weird way. I don't know. And I feel like in a weird way, Kaneda should have said something to add to the mystery, to complicate things, to give Searle something to chew on in his own journey. But he doesn't say anything. He just screams. So we don't get any furthering of that mystery. And it pretty much is, from here on out, they don't do much with it to make it something that you want to follow, you know? So, aftermath. The O2 farm is gone. Trey, who's played by Benedict Wong, who I really like, he's such a terrific actor, he feels horrible. He's like, I fucked up. He's the suicide watch, basically, because Kaneda is dead and he blames himself for not remembering to reset the shield. And now the comm officer, Harvey, is in command, who's just, you know, kind of a second-in-command dude. We find out there's not enough oxygen to get to the destination, and they definitely have to rendezvous with the Icarus One, which is the point of all this. But they were kind of going there anyway. So, yeah, I mean, obviously they're doing more with, you know, characters and sacrifice, which is going to come right now. Corazon says, you know, this is not so much a problem, but we have to draw straws to conserve oxygen, and we have to lose three people, right? And the idea is that they could, you know, if they lost three people, they could get to their destination, but they wouldn't have any for the return journey. And they wouldn't have to rendezvous with Icarus One, but, you know, of course, they're not going to make that choice right now. And so they decide to, you know, now it's a no-brainer. The Icarus One rendezvous has to happen. And we get a brief scene of Kappa and Cassie, and he's, you know, again, you know, messing with his payload, and they have this brief discussion, are you afraid to die? And she is. She's like, I know we're going to die out here. And she's a very unsympathetic character. She's just kind of a downer the entire movie, and she's always in a kind of somber mood and always saying somber things, and there's not really much to her. Kappa is, you know, in a way, she's kind of contrasting Kappa, who's very much into his bomb and not afraid to die and really completely letting go into the mission, realizing that that may be true, but he's not afraid, you know. So it's also setting up what happens to Kappa at the end of the film. We see more and more that Searle's skin is like, he looks terrible, like his skin is constantly peeling because he's spending too much time in the observation lounge trying to crank up the sunlight, pushing into that spiritual union that he keeps talking about, which I kind of like. They find the Icarus One, and they, you know, they kind of mate with it in a way that the two shields kind of go together. The Icarus Two is a bit larger, so its shield is larger, and the shields overlap. So they basically, Searle, Mace, Kappa, and Harvey basically head on over into the ship, and the Icarus Two detaches from its heat shield and moves over to the Icarus One, does a hard seal with airlock to airlock, which that doesn't kind of make any sense. I don't think they would, you know, you would risk something like a full hard seal with two massive ships like that. You would just go in suits, you know, and head into the airlock. But whatever, it's filmed pretty cool. And to see the two ships together blocking the sun, the two discs overlapping, it's really beautiful. So then they enter the Icarus One, and there's some strange photography that happens in here. And as soon as they open the airlock and they come into the ship and it's dark and they're playing the lights around, for the next couple of minutes, we see these quick flashes in front of our eyes of photographs of the Icarus One crew. Not really sure what that's about, frankly. It's just, it's the beginning of Danny Boyle playing kind of fast and loose with the visuals in this film. So it's a little strange. And we see different crew members each time. And only later, when we see the whole full picture of them together on the side of one of the walls, do we realize that it's, you know, it was the Icarus One crew. The air is full of dust. It's like layered on all of the surfaces. And we're told that it's human skin. So we're getting a little teased as to what possibly happened to the crew. There's this moment of, you know, covering the ship faster as they split up. And we have Mace say, I think Searle at one point says, I don't think splitting up's a good idea. And Mace says, well, are you worried we're going to get picked off by aliens? This film is going to be an alien ripoff soon enough that you're going to try to poke me in the eye in the audience, and you're going to give me that little, you know, that little elbow in the ribs to say, you know, haha, this is like Alien. And like then the movie becomes like Alien. It's sort of like, if you're going to name check Alien, name check it because you're going to do something different, not because you're going to do exactly the same thing. So I found that very odd. So, however, you know, searching the Icarus One, I love the sci-fi trope of the derelict lost ship that has to be discovered, right? It's such a great trope. So even in this movie, I'm like, I love that they do this classic SF adventure. Like, it's a derelict ship. They don't know why it's gone. They don't know what happened to the crew. And here they are, you know, in the ship searching around. It's a classic SF trope, but it's a trope and it's classic because I think it's so powerful and it works so often. And you have to really go far to screw up a trope like this. So it's really cool. They discover the O2 farm on the Icarus One is completely overgrown, like it's massive growth. So it's been 7 years since they last heard from the ship. They hear this recording from Pinbacker, who's, you know, the commander of the mission, saying that they have willfully abandoned the mission. And he sounds like he's kind of going off his rocker, saying we are dust, nothing more. Into dust we will return. And that, you know, this Pinbacker thesis is that it's not our place to challenge God. If God wants the human race to die, it's not our place to challenge that. And, you know, so something happened. And what sucks is you really don't get a sense of what happens. Even by the end of the film, you don't really know. And I think the writer and director wanted to sort of play with mystery elements to keep it mysterious. But it's mysterious in that it's boring. It's not mysterious that you've given me enough to tantalize me, like what could have happened. Like, give me a little bit more, man. Give me some more logs. Give me some writing. Give me something to hook into. Not just a line from pinbacker that's like, you know, we've decided that we're not going to go against God. It was like, it was too broad for me. So I was kind of disappointed. So suddenly there's this breach. The airlock is breached somehow. There's an explosion. Icarus 2 is blown away from Icarus 1. The airlock, what they say, is decoupled. So the airlock now on the Icarus 1 no longer works. There's a hull breach. And there's only one there. So it's basically, it's May, Searle, Harvey, and Kappa in the airlock. And there's only one suit. So we're going to get, like, it's a whole 2001 callback right now. So then there's this moment that I feel is kind of off with the what they've set up the film to be. Pretty much right up till now, what little character development we have had has been, most of the characters are pretty much on board with, you know, this being an incredible mission and the sacrifices are going to be made. And it's not a lot of, like, uber dramatics in terms of, like, turn your key. No, you turn your key. Everyone's pretty much, like, you know, a fairly enlightened scientist. They know the drill. They're kind of resigned to it. And now Mace basically is like, you know, we have to give Kappa the suit because, you know, he's not expendable, the rest of us are. And so Harvey's like, no, get out of that suit, Kappa. I'm the commander of that ship, and I'm going to go back to the original ship, and we'll send something back for you. So Harvey basically goes into an ass-saving mode, basically to create drama here, which I don't think you need it. First of all, you don't need it because he winds up getting talked out of it. So it's sort of like a dramatic arc that diffuses immediately because of the real enough surroundings. I just found it a weird blip. But so then Mace kind of lays out the parameters where, you know, the mainframe computer on the Icarus 1 is down, the ship is dead. So the airlock has to be operated manually, so one of them is going to have to stay behind. And Searle immediately volunteers, even as Harvey is saying, what? It's going to be me. You're all looking at me. And Searle's like, no, you idiot. It's going to be me. And basically then Mace kind of intervenes, and he's like, look, we'll hold on to Kappa, and we'll wrap ourselves in this material and you know, basically do what David Bowman, right? You know, close your eyes really tightly, don't open your mouth, breathe out slowly, all the things that he did. So they do this thing, and, you know, they align the ships together, and they blow, and Searle blows them out of the airlock, and, of course, Harvey, because he's been, and I don't know why the writer, maybe the writers wanted to make Harvey kind of a douche because he's about to die. I thought that was kind of like, well, why would you do that? If everyone's in such survival mode here and such sacrifice mode, why would you? I don't understand the choices. Let's put it that way. And Kappa grabs Mace, throws him in the airlock, but it's too late for Harvey, so they, you know, they get in there, and you know, Mace has suffered some a little bit of hypothermia, and he's got this massive frostbite on one hand, which is really cool. But he's made it, you know, and so, and then they do this weird thing where they really focus on Harvey, and they focus on his face freezing, they focus on his last breath, they focus on his arm shattering on some protuberance of his, you know, it's sort of like we're starting to get into horror movie mode now. We've come from this earnest and awe-inspired notion of science and, you know, and Mercury and these scientists and what they're up against. Now we're getting more into, like, you know, nitty-gritty kind of B horror movie where we're focusing on, you know, how Harvey's body comes apart in detail. And it immediately kind of was like a needle scratching a record for me. I'm like, this is a different movie. It's starting to feel like a different movie. That argument in the airlock, focusing on Harvey's disintegrating body and as it blows up, he's supposed to be like, it's almost like a horror movie death. Like, ooh, look, you know, his arm shattered in a million pieces. And it just rubbed me wrong. It was really odd. And then the next beat, Searle goes to the observation lounge in the Icarus One. He's going to finally do it. He's going to open it up all the way. And you hear Cassie's voiceover. And it's like, it's so unconvincing. It's so, this moment is so devoid. They don't give Searle any real last words. I don't think the writer knew what to do here. Like, he had two non-characters, kind of. And Rose was like, hey, Searle, we just wanted to say goodbye. We're leaving now. So that's all. Signing off. Like, it's just so bad. You know, like my God, no one else gets on. No one else says anything. She's the only one. And then Searle cranks up the observation lounge and obviously burns to death. But we don't get any kind of sense of, did he discover something? We don't get any close-up on his face or his eyes. He just fries, you know, and that's it for Searle. Weird. So then there's the aftermath on the Icarus 2. They realize that the airlock was decoupled manually, that it was not a malfunction. So no one really understands how it happened. Corazon reminds them now that, you know, they actually lost two bodies, so Searle and Harvey are gone. They only need to lose one more, and that Trey, you know, they vote on whether or not to kill Trey because he's not really needed anymore, and without him, they'll have enough oxygen to get to the bomb drop point. So Mace does this thing where it's like, we'll vote. It has to be unanimous. And we can see the Cap is upset by the whole thing. And then there's an on-the-nose dialogue by Mace. Stop trying to remind us of our lost humanity, Cap. You know, it's just very grade school. And it just felt very out of place in a movie that's being so oblique in so many other ways. All of a sudden, they have to say something, and it's just like clunk, you know, on-the-nose dialogue. So that's something that should have been non-verbally apprehended by the audience without being told. So it really rang false to me. This is the point of the film now where the lack of characters is really starting to tell, because now they're in for the marbles. They've, you know, some my favorite character, Searle, is dead. Harvey's dead. Kaneda is dead. You know, Trey's about to die. And all this stuff is happening because we're not, in some weird way, in movies, like, you only really experience the events of the movie as successfully as you can identify with the characters and how they're experiencing it, you know? So if you're watching a Clint Eastwood movie and, like, you know, these incredible things are happening all around him and he's like, I'm all fresh out of mercy. You know, you're laughing and like, whatever. But if another character's in his place that's like flinching and getting hurt and in pain and frightened, we'll latch on to that as an audience member. So, you know, I'm only in this movie as far as I'm into the characters in the movie. And I'm not into any of these people at all. Like, I want to be into Kappa, but he's sort of like this kind of very terse, you know, doesn't speak often like Svengali, you know. And Mace is kind of like the gung-ho American, and he's not that interesting either. And Cassie is just kind of dull. Corazon is boring. She's kind of a non-character, you know. So, and now when shit's starting to go down, I'm looking around, and I'm just like, well, who am I hanging on to here as my character through this experience? And nobody, you know. So I like Mace. I like Chris Evans anyway. So I like Mace once in a while. He has these moments, but there's not much going on here character-wise. So this should be a very tough, tense scene about they're going to kill Trey. But you know what? It rings so false to me that I don't really care, you know. So they all vote yes, of course. Cassie votes no. It's all ridiculous that she would vote no, like, and they don't discuss it. Like, so, you know, if she votes no, have a discussion about it and explicate her reasons to me, the audience. And let me hear what's going on here. Have it be a thing. And she's like, you don't have my vote. I don't care. And then, of course, Mace gets up and he goes to do it. And then they've built up all this tension about they have to kill Trey. And he's already dead. They get to the thing and he's found a, you know, a scalpel and he's opened up his veins. So it's weird. I'm sort of like, you know, if you're gonna do this, this would have been a test of Mace's character. If Mace had to show up and Trey would have been like, I heard what happened. This is horrible. You know, how can I help? Or I'm really sorry, whatever. And Mace had to still kill the guy. That would have been something to see. And it would have been stakes and it would have, you know, Mace's character would have been deepened. But he gets the easy out. He shows up and Trey already killed himself. And then there's a goofy scene where Mace has them all come down and Corazon runs over and she's like, he cut his wrists. And like, yeah, we can all see he cut his wrist, Corazon. Like, it's so dumb. It's just, I don't know what happened here with the movie because it's really starting to come apart. So then there's a one cool sci-fi thing where the AI kind of notifies, I think, Kappa that there's not enough oxygen to get them to the payload delivery point. He's like, wait a minute, there's only four crew members. And he's like, no, there's five. The fifth member is unknown, and he's in the observation room right now. So Kappa bolts to the observation room, and he finds a prone body, and the screen is dialed down to such a degree where you can barely see in there. So, like, it's way higher than even when Searle was in there. And now we're starting our visual trickery to distract us from the fact that there's really no story left. And it's Pinbacker. And obviously, over the years, he's developed. He can take so much more sunlight. It's almost part of his body. And there's some cool photography. You know, it looks cool what they do, where we never really get a full-on shot of Pinbacker. It's always oblique shots. It's almost as if Pinbacker is too bright and is shining too brightly for us to even get a full look at him, that he's somehow been imbued with a certain level of sunlight, possible spirituality. We don't know. But of course, now we start the horror movie, and he has a scalpel, and he slashes Kappa in the gut. Kappa bolts out of there, and we have this chase. You know, Kappa traps himself in an airlock, and Pinbacker can't get in. So Pinbacker goes to the mainframe. He pulls the computer up out of the coolant, which is going to now sabotage it. He finds Corazon in her garden, and he kills her, basically comes up behind her and just stabs her, and she's dead, and we don't really care. And now we're in kind of a full-on horror movie. There's a Mace is unaware of what's going on, and Cassie and the ship is in the dark now, and there's a lot of trick photography. We don't, to cover the lack of story, we don't really know who's where or what's happening. So Mace now realizes that the mainframe is offline. So he's in this whole thing where he sacrifices himself to save the ship. And he goes into this coolant and he's fixing the mainframe, and little by little it's coming back online. But his body temperature is dropping. I think it's like liquid oxygen. It's insanely cold. And so he's slowly dying as he's fixing the mainframe and sacrificing himself, which is great. Pinbacker is chasing Cassie, and we don't know, she's hiding from him and running from him. When the ship comes back online and lights come on, she stabs him and runs away. And Mace does, we see actually Mace die. So then Kappa gets out by blowing the airlock, which rips the door on the inner airlock out, and all of the ship now is airless. It basically exposes the inside of the ship to vacuum. So he's in a suit, very David Bowman 2001, right? Cassie has vanished. We don't know where she is. He sees Mace is dead. He separates the payload from the ship. And there's this tension-building scene where the payload separates from the ship, but Cap is not on it. And so he has to boost himself away from the Icarus II. And it's a beautiful shot. Like, the camera goes back and we see the payload going further and further. And, you know, Cap is slowly catching up to it and he grabs on. And finally, the retro rockets fire and the payload now is shooting down towards the surface of the sun. You know, I still don't know where everyone is or where everyone is going. I know in my heart as I'm watching this that Pinbacker somehow made it to the payload because, you know, he's the alien, as it were, who, you know, usually shows up at the end. You know, he's in this large bomb. Cassie is there. Somehow she got there while the ship was still tethered. Whatever, it's fine. And then Pinbacker is there and they have this battle. And, you know, we hear from Pinbacker again. He restates his theme, like, who are we to say no to God? And I've had a vision and blah, blah, blah. It's all very boring. And I wish they would have given Pinbacker some interesting things to say because it's such a cool idea. The notion that this man, you know, maybe got as close to God as humanly possible while still holding on to one's humanity, and like, it drove him mad, you know, like, what's to come with Kappa? He's going to let go of himself and kind of flow into the light in a different way. But Pinbacker, like, it drove him crazy. So I love that those two sides of it are there, but they don't develop it at all. You know, I mean, they're so afraid to touch that stuff at all, probably because I think both of the guys are avowed atheists and they don't have an inside track on faith. They don't really understand what's going on. So they had the idea, which was great, but they didn't really know too much about either side of it. So I find that interesting. So then there's a really terrible action sequence where, you know, Cassie and Kappa are running down and they slide down the bomb and they're fighting with Pinbacker. They rip his arm off, so they're away from Pinbacker. There's catwalks. And then finally, you know, they get to the point where Kappa ignites the bomb. You know, I think Cassie's there with him. But, you know, he's basically sees this, the thing start to, you know, react. So, you know, one, as he said earlier, one atom knocking into another, fissile, more and more, you know, having a chain reaction. The music is pummeling me right now, telling me that something of really dramatic import is happening, but it's not, you know, like, it's all been kind of cobbled and hurtled together, and none of it really sticks right now. And there's this wonderful moment where, you know, the reaction comes, and it doesn't make any sense, but I like it anyway. Like, Kappa seems to be standing right at the dividing line between the bomb and the actual sun itself. And he's slowly subsumed by the sun, which is kind of beautiful, you know? And I get an emotional moment from that, which I really like, but there's been so much hogwash and nonsense in the last, you know, 40 minutes of the Pinbacker alien crap that I just, at this point, I'm like, wow, this thing has really collapsed from its own weight, which really sucks, you know? The last bit of the movie is we're shooting the frozen glaciated Earth, and Kappa's sister comes out with her child, and of course the sun rises and it's a lot brighter than we've seen before, and we get a voiceover again of earlier him saying, if you see a particularly bright sunrise, you'll know we succeeded, and the film ends. So, you know, just to summarize Sunshine, like, it's such a mess of interesting ideas and failed execution. You know, like, it starts out so well mounted, so beautiful, so science-oriented, you know, like, you know, the O2 farm and Mercury and the whole idea that they got to restart the sun. There's a scientific mission, you know, it's not bad guys, right? It's done with a lot of respect and a lot of awe and wonder, and I love it, you know. And even the, you know, the fixing the solar panels and the crisis that is driven by a human error that he forgot to reset the shield, I dig all that, even though there's a lot of gray and a lot of confusion directorially in all this area. I still like its base there. And then once they get to the Icarus II, it becomes alien, you know, and they, I mean, they actually say it in the bloody movie, but it really does. It really turns into alien. You know, we're not really on board with any of these characters. The story's really not developed enough where we really care at this point, you know, and once it devolves into this kind of thing, just implausibility upon implausibility, and how does Pinbacker get to the ship, and how has he survived, and his existence is fascinating, but what they do with it, to me, it just totally drops the ball, you know? So Danny Boyle had said, I think I said this earlier, but that after when they finished this film, he was done with science fiction, and that the production exhausted him. And they had, you know, they had plenty of latitude with Fox Searchlight. They spent a lot of time writing the film. So it boggles my mind because it feels like a film that was, you know, that the suits came in and destroyed. Because it feels like they may have had a full-on sci-fi film from beginning to end. And what happened was somebody came in and said, no, this ain't going to sell. Let's make it a horror movie at the end of it, and let's have a guy running around cutting people's heads off. And that's kind of what it is. And it kind of betrays the initial idea of the movie, which is so great, you know. So, you know, I watch Sunshine every once in a while. You know, it's one of those movies I put back on. I own it on Blu-ray. I like it. It looks beautiful. I love kind of reacquainting myself with the failed but really cool idea of, you know, the sun being a metaphor for God. And, you know, as you get closer, you know, what kind of person actually gets more and more okay with that, and what kind of person goes insane. And, you know, I have my own little mini movie going on in my head. So I love that the film has these ideas, but man, the execution-wise, it's very disappointing. So a little bit of trivia about Sunshine. Danny Boyle was so impressed with Michelle Yao's audition that he told her that she could choose any part in the script and he would give it to her. He was even prepared to change the gender if she had chosen a male character. She ultimately decided on Corazon, the biologist, which, it's very strange. It's kind of a non-character. The cast members all underwent space training and learned how to scuba dive. Among the films that Danny Boyle insisted that they all watch were The Right Stuff and For All Mankind. Boyle also took his cast on a tour of a nuclear sub to help them better understand cramped living conditions. And he also had them experience weightlessness in zero-G environment of an acrobatic plane. Actual sounds received from space were captured by a Midwestern university were incorporated into the sound design of the film. So this is very interesting. It plays into my frustration with the film. In the character biographies / background stories given to the actors in order to prepare for the film, several facts were revealed about them that weren't stated in the film. For example, Kappa had been obsessed with the Icarus mission ever since he was a kid and felt like an outsider because he's not an astronaut like the rest of the group. Cassie was an Air Force pilot before entering the space program. She was also pregnant and had an abortion in order to be able to participate in the mission. Corazon felt more strongly about the plants and the oxygen garden than her fellow crew members. In her final recorded message to her husband, she didn't speak and instead simply looked lovingly at the camera for a full minute. She was also the only member of the group to never use the Earth room. Harvey worked on the Icarus 1 mission as a junior engineer. Out of the whole group, he scored the highest in all the fitness tests. His only weakness is his dependence and attachment to his wife and the fear that he will never see her again. He struggles with this throughout the whole mission. Kaneda is very protective of Kappa because he knows that he feels like an outsider. He's obsessed with Icarus 1 and what led to its downfall. Mace comes from a military family and grew up in military bases. He's very clear-headed, and when he attacked Kappa, it was the exception, not the rule. He has pride and is honest. Unfortunately, this comes across as rude or cold to those around him. Mace developed feelings for Cassie at the Icarus 2 training camp, but stifled and ignored those feelings in order to focus on the mission. As a result, he dreams of her every night. Now, if you had given me some of that in the movie, it would have, it would have helped me with the characters. It would have helped me with Harvey's decision to want to take the suit. It would have been wonderful to add maybe another 10 minutes to the film, salted in, where we get to know these people. And then I care. So I think it's funny that this trivia bit kind of sums up my problem with the movie, that all of that should have been in the film. So yeah, this is another odd thing. The DVD commentaries from Danny Boyle and Brian Cox can conflict on whether Trey actually committed suicide as first appears or whether Pinbacker killed Trey and made it look like a suicide, which is what happened according to Boyle. Cox states that Benedict Wong felt his character had in fact committed suicide. When Mace opens the drawer, there are two scalpels missing, which could support either scenario. However, it seems very unlikely that the insane Pinbacker would have sufficient motive or patience to fake Trey's suicide, especially when he later is seen trying to murder the rest of the crew as fast as he can. So, right. There's that. Garland's script had heavily featured notions of God and atheism that Boyle chose to downplay to help the film find an audience. Well, there you go. This is interesting as a last bit. In 1953, the sci-fi horror and fantasy writer Clark Ashton Smith wrote a short story called Phoenix, in which an interstellar spaceship is launched to reignite an almost dead sun with a payload of atomic bombs made of every element. The crew and the ship perish in the attempt, but succeed by crashing the payload into the sun, triggering a series of detonations. The story ends with the lover of one of the crew basking in the sunshine of the reborn sun and imagining her lover returning to her, quote, in the sunlight, end quote. So very interesting. So that's all I have to say about Sunshine. I hope you enjoyed it, and I'll see you next time.